From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And an unprecedented blessing in the Senate has big implications for Democrats and President Biden. Last night, Democrats said the Senate's nonpartisan parliamentarian, the in-house rules expert, ruled that Democrats could use the reconciliation process more than once in a fiscal year. Okay, let's back up because that sentence can be dizzying. Reconciliation allows budget measures to pass with a simple majority, like just one vote, instead of the supermajority often required for major legislation. You might remember Senate Democrats already used the maneuver to push through Biden's $1.9 trillion relief package last month without any Republican votes. Well, the ruling last night could clear the way for the president's infrastructure and jobs package to pass in the same way. Here to help me explain is NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. And so talk more about that, Sue, what this means as President Biden is now pushing his $2 trillion American jobs plan.
Well, as you noted, the budget reconciliation process is something that's born out of the annual budgeting process. And normally, I think there was a broad view of acceptance in Capitol Hill that you get a one-and-done bite of that apple with each annual budget process. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he interpreted the budget law differently, and he went to the Senate parliamentarian to say, is my interpretation of the budget law correct? Now, I want to caution here, we have not seen the actual parliamentarian's ruling. We've only gotten the interpretation given to them through Schumer's office, so it is coming through a bit of a partisan lens. But Schumer's office last night said that the parliamentarian did agree with him that they could pass more than one bill using the reconciliation package. Now, this could open up any number of potential opportunities for Democrats, not just for this infrastructure bill, but for other controversial legislation that involves tax and spending that Democrats want to get through this year. I think, frankly, Democrats were always looking at reconciliation as the vehicle to pass this $2 trillion or what they can of this $2 trillion infrastructure proposal. This just makes it likely that they can do more pieces of it in more vehicles and get more done.
Yeah. Well, budget reconciliation only applies to budget bills, not say gun control or voting reform. So the question is, would this entire bill fit in that budget category, this infrastructure bill? Republicans, as you know, say no. And by the way, we said this was a blessing. Well, for Democrats, maybe. But Republicans say only a fraction of the money would go to, you know, as they say, real infrastructure issues like home care or electric vehicles. They shouldn't count. Here's Republican Roy Blunt of Missouri on ABC's This Week.
I understand the dynamic of taking a popular title and wrapping it around a big bill that it's a fairly small percentage of, but it's the difference in whether you'd have a bipartisan easy win or a very partisan broad-based $2.25 trillion package.
So, Sue, what more are Republicans saying?
Well, I think Roy Blunt has a point here. This isn't just about infrastructure. You know, it's the common term we're using for it, but this bill is so much more than that. I mean, I think it's been likened more to something along the lines of the New Deal. I mean, we're talking about $2 trillion here, and he is right that there's much more in this bill beyond just building up traditional infrastructure. Democrats are also using it as a vehicle to address climate change, racial inequities, healthcare in some regards. It is an expansive government intervention into almost every aspect of our lives. And Democrats will point to the fact that if you actually ask people what they think about these proposals, they often tend to be quite popular, as we saw with the stimulus checks and with the economic stimulus package. The country likes it. The country likes it when the government's spending money. So Biden has sort of redefined what he views bipartisan as is not necessarily seeking the approval of Republicans in Congress, but seeking a majority of approval of the country as the metric for what should and shouldn't get done in Washington.
Well, and we also know that Democrats are turning themselves into pretzels to show that climate is infrastructure. You need runoff ditches on the roads, you know, alongside roads for rising waters, things like that. But,
yeah. You
know, President Biden and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg say the plan could also add millions of jobs.
They could. And I mean, frankly, it probably can. This is one of the reasons why traditionally infrastructure and highway bills have been very popular in Congress. This kind of spending does tend to have an economic boost and it does tend to have a job boost. I mean, you need people to build these buildings and to repave these roads and to improve electric car access and all of those things. I mean, that would likely be a conclusion of it. What I think the philosophical difference is here is that the Republican Party continues to maintain the view that this isn't the role of government to do this, that they want to rely more on private enterprise and on the free market versus having the government play such an intense financial role in juicing the economy. You know, I think that they're going to have a bit of an uphill battle here because Democrats clearly have the process on their side. The question is, can they keep the party unified behind it?
And we only have a few seconds, but as you said, we haven't yet seen this ruling from the Senate parliamentarian. But is there a sense that it could just make all the objections moot?
No. I mean, they really do need to keep 50 Democrats in line in the Senate. You lose one Democrat and the whole thing falls apart. So I still think Democrats have a very, very, very high bar to try to cobble together something that is hugely expansive legislation and get it through without any Republican support. That is not going to be easy.
No. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, almost every state in the country now has plans to make everyone over the age of 16 eligible for a COVID vaccine by or before April 19th. That matches a target date that President Biden is expected to announce later today. Nearly 19% of Americans have now been fully vaccinated, more than 62 million people. But for some, getting any dose at all is almost impossible if they can't leave their homes. Colorado Public Radio's Tina Sieg tells us about an effort to bring vaccines to medically vulnerable residents in Mesa County, Colorado.
For months, Mary Salinas has seen images of people getting their COVID-19 vaccine on the news. Finally, it's her turn.
All right. Do you want a countdown or a surprise?
No, just a surprise.
Okay, go ahead and relax. There you go. Take a deep breath.
Mita White, a physician assistant student, presses a needle into Salinas' arm.
Little sting there. And you're done. That was it.
Yeah, that's so fast.
A totally standard vaccine experience, except that Salinas got hers while sitting in an easy chair in her apartment.
Oh, it's wonderful because I really can't get out anymore.
She has mobility issues and a lot of pain. It would be difficult to get her safely downtown to where the vaccine is being distributed.
I wanted it immediately, and I'm 72, so I should have it right away. But I didn't know if it would be a long time before I could get a shot. So this is a total surprise for me today.
Salinas is one of 154 people getting shots delivered to them on this day. All recipients are residents of the Grand Junction Housing Authority's independent living communities, where mostly seniors live in individual homes but receive more support than if they were completely on their own. At the Nellie Bechtel Senior Apartments, it feels like a party outside the community center as residents wait for their shots.
Lucky day!
Lucky day!
A woman claps her hands after she's called up. All around her are eager seniors in masks, some with canes and oxygen tanks. All this excitement is a big deal for a county where some people still question how real the virus is.
Yeah, in the beginning, I thought it was somebody told me it was a conspiracy.
And 68-year-old Diana Love says she believed that for a while.
And then I thought, oh, that is so stupid.
Watching the news helped change her mind. So did talking with her friends. Now she knows what she'd say to someone who won't get the vaccine.
I tell them, you know what? It's all up to us to keep other people safe.
Love worries she could get her grandkids sick. Mary Salinas, who got the shot in her apartment, is scared she could infect the babies of her home health aides. And that's what these residents keep coming back to. Not their own health, but everyone else's, despite their own increased risk.
You know, when you look at those that had the most serious consequences from getting COVID, this is the group.
Amy Bronson runs Colorado Mesa University's Physician Assistant Program. Sitting in her car between vaccine events, she says many of these seniors have been isolated for more than a year.
And so to be able to know that by getting a vaccine, then it's going to open up some of life for them again, I think it's just a huge piece of their mental and well-being.
Vaccine skepticism is an issue here. When the county's healthcare workers were offered vaccines in December and January, only about 50% decided to take them. But these seniors are not hesitant, especially when they can get vaccinated on their front patio, like Teresa Montano.
I'm not scared of shots at all.
Good.
I'm looking forward to this one.
The 71-year-old asks physician assistant Mita White whether she'll have to come back to deliver a second dose. But like everyone this day, Montano is getting the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
All right, I'll take the one and done.
Even better.
I'll grab it.
Montano has her EpiPen at the ready, just in case. But she doesn't have a serious reaction to the shot, except for relief.
I feel good. I'm so happy. You don't know how it feels when you don't know where you're going to go get your shot, and it's real important to get the shot. You have to protect everybody. And that's what I'm doing. I'm protecting myself and all my friends and my neighbors.
Montano says she might even restart her outdoor neighborhood coffee club once it warms up enough. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
The trial of Derek Chauvin resumed today in Minneapolis with another police officer taking the stand. Chauvin is charged with murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. Yesterday, Police Chief Madaria Arredondo testified saying that Chauvin violated police department policy when he held his knee on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes.
Once Mr. Floyd had stopped resisting, and certainly once he was in distress and trying to verbalize that, that should have stopped.
Joining us now is Cedric Alexander. He is the former police chief and public safety director of DeKalb County, Georgia. Cedric, thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me, Peter.
Well, yesterday, that was a big moment in this trial with the chief of police on the stand. What were you thinking when you saw him up there testifying against one of his former officers?
Well, certainly this is a very unusual case, and I can't think of any time in my past 40 years in and out of policing where I've ever seen a chief testify against one of their own personnel. But when I watched Chief Arredondo there, he was the highest caliber of professionalism. I thought the chief did an excellent job in explaining his understanding and, of course, his policies, and particularly around use of force training. And he was a very good witness.
You say it was very rare. Have you ever come anywhere near an experience like that in your own career?
No, in the course of my career, and I've chiefed two police departments in this country. And here again, this was a very different case. One that millions of people around the world watched on video, and we can still continue to see this act take place on video. And the chief must have felt he had a responsibility to stand up and say, this is not the conduct that's becoming of my men and women in this police department in the use of force. And it took a lot of courage on his part.
Well, he wasn't just the chief. The jury also heard from a 35-year veteran of the force, Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, and Chauvin's former supervisor, the retired Sergeant David Pluger, all of them testifying against Chauvin. What do you think the impact on the jury is to hear from those officers?
First of all, we have to certainly understand they're all very credible. And under oath, they told exactly what they knew, how they experienced things, and what was proper protocol, and they did what they were supposed to do, and they did it in a way that was open and transparent.
Because this has been so rare, do you think that this moment marks a shift or a weakness in this so-called blue wall, that we may now see more officers in the future willing to speak out or testify against other cops?
Well, you know, I often hear that term, blue wall of silence, and that type of thing. That is no coordinated effort on parts of anyone in policing. Policing is just like any other profession. When people get to know each other or depend upon each other in order to get a job or mission done, people develop a sense of camaraderie. But the most important thing here to remember as we move forward in American policing, that's yes, the example that we saw from that training inspector, from Chief Arredondo, and from Lieutenant Zimmerman, they role model for all of us. This is how we deal with things that are not right. We don't hide it. We don't cover up. We tell the truth under oath. And even when we're not under oath, we tell the truth when no one is watching.
The trainer you reference is Inspector Katie Blackwell. Here she is. We're going to listen to a bit of her testimony here, talking about the restraint that Chauvin used on Floyd. Here it is.
Per policy, a neck restraint is compressing one or both sides of the neck using an arm or leg. But what we train is using one arm or two arm to do a neck restraint.
And how does this differ?
I don't know what kind of improvised position that is. So that's not what we train.
So Blackwell essentially saying there, whatever Chauvin was doing was improvised. It was beyond the training. Now, that has been the focus of a lot of the testimony among these law enforcement officers. The prosecution trying to make the case that Chauvin acted not just outside the bounds of policy, but also outside the bounds of the law. Do you think the prosecution has been successful in making that case?
Well, certainly they've been successful, but this case is still a long way from being over. But yes, they have been successful. And their testimonies, quite frankly, is very damaging to the defense. And they have been able to articulate their points very well based on the law and also based on their policies they have there within Minneapolis Police Department.
Cedric Alexander is the former police chief and public safety director of DeKalb County, Georgia. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Well, let's bring in Ed Denmark, police chief in Harvard, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston, far removed from Harvard, the school, and violent police incidents. But he's been watching over three decades with a sinking heart as he moved from an excited black rookie to a chief who called policing broken. And now he's working with researchers at George Mason University to develop a new way of training. And Chief Denmark, you've said after the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, cops were forced into bias training and that backfired. But you've had success. For instance, you took down posted stat sheets that you loved as a rookie that celebrated the highest arrest numbers. Why?
It takes and makes a game, so to speak, out of people's personal lives. I was trying to raise numbers in order to be viewed by my peers in a certain light, but I didn't understand or wasn't recognized the consequences that could have on people's real personal lives. You know, we are negatively impacting their potential to get a job, their ability to keep housing. To me, you know, just because someone violated a law doesn't always mean that criminal sanction is the best way to change the behavior. And it took me a long time to figure that out.
Yeah, but you know what many others in the policing world say to that. That's a social worker's job.
Well, see, I would push back on that and say, you know what, this is the mistake we've made throughout history. Policing is a social worker's job. It's a conglomeration of psychology, sociology, anthropology, biology, all of the things that make human beings human. And that's why, in my opinion, this is why we're having such a hard time addressing it through training, is because we're not looking at the root causes of the behaviors of the officers in the field when they are confronted with situations.
Talk about what you're talking to George Mason about and training techniques so that there is some of this thinking that you talked about.
We're looking at things more from a conflict management, conflict resolution perspective. The folks down at George Mason have done some incredible work over in the Middle East in some conflict zones. I do some violent extremism prevention work in the Middle East and Africa as well. And the thought was, well, if we can bring peace to these other places that are war-torn, what lessons learned from those areas can we take and front-load that into our police officers before they even go into the field? And I'm also a use of force instructor and all of the, so I'm not just the soft, touchy-feely instructor, but I want people to recognize that when force is used, we play a role in that. And that's not saying it's our fault. Certain neighborhoods, certain ethnic groups, when we show up, before we even step out of the car, there's a conflict, and that conflict is based in history and experiences and shared stories from within those communities. So we have to be mindful of what we bring to the table in conflict if we're to be expected to mitigate conflict or minimize escalation of force.
I'm sure you've had people say to you, easy for you to say in lovely, leafy, sleepy Harvard, Mass, you don't face the challenges of an inner city. What do you say to that, to the cop who says, I got a wife and kids I need to go home to, and that's all that matters?
That's the point of this, is like human behavior is human behavior, and we still have drugs. We still have domestic violence. We still have all the social problems that other places of larger populations have. When I say I want to go home to my wife and children, my response to them is, I'm looking to create a safer space for you as the officer. If we are more mindful of what we're doing, we can put ourselves in a position to better recognize when we are losing our abilities to think straight. Because under stress, and especially in a survival mode, our cognitive abilities can be reduced by up to 50%. So we start making bad decisions. And I always say to them, you know, nobody wants to be the cop that accidentally shoots the guy with a cell phone.
You've said you're hearing far more criticism of Derek Chauvin than you've ever heard before. Is it at least helping cops to see, I don't want to be Derek Chauvin?
I think it is. I think that the byproduct of this whole thing is the broken trust between the police and the communities. Officers don't understand why people of color look at them and say, well, that could be me. Mm-hmm. And whether or not the statistics back that notion up or not is irrelevant, because the feeling and the emotion of that is real. And then, and also the pain on the face of some of my officers. I mean, I've one of the best cops I've ever had in my entire life, really feeling badly about everything, the way things happened last summer, and really looked disturbed. And I asked the officers, you know, what's the problem? And the officer said to me that, you know, I'm tired of people judging me for what I chose to do. And I said to the officer, I said, well, yeah, just think, you get to take that uniform off at 4 o'clock, and then no one knows what you do. You could take off the blue uniform, but I've worn the brown uniform for 53 years and don't get to take it off. And said, you know, now you get a little taste of what it feels like to be judged just by what you look like or what group you're associated with. And it was a real learning moment for that officer.
What would the officer say?
The officer said, wow, I get it. I understand it's not the same, but I get it. I get what that feels like now.
Ted Denmark, police chief in Harvard, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. Chief Denmark, thank you. Best of luck to you.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about movies, music, and more, like why The Great Pottery Throwdown is a comforting binge watch, and a look back at some of Chadwick Boseman's essential performances. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces two challenges right now. He's trying to form a new government from the country's splintered parliament, but he's also on trial for corruption charges. Journalist Neri Zilber joins us from Tel Aviv. And Neri, start with a new government. Netanyahu has 51 seats in the 120-seat Knesset, short of the 61-seat majority he needs, numbers like we have here. Can he convince anyone else to join him while he's on trial?
That's the question everyone is asking. It's an evenly divided country, split almost in half between those who support Netanyahu and those who are adamantly opposed to Netanyahu. And that's what Netanyahu is facing right now. His chances aren't great. Even the president who tasked him today with this mandate to form a government said, no one really has a good chance, but I have to task somebody. And and so now this is a real test for Netanyahu.
Boy, that is kind of depressing there. But what he's very powerful, Netanyahu, but what leverage does he have?
Number one, he has the bully pulpit of the office of the prime minister. He's going to try to persuade some smaller breakaway right-wing factions to disavow the promises they made during the election campaign and come over and back to him. That's a tough sell. Barring that, he may try to seat a minority government with the outside support of an Islamist Arab-Israeli party, which is very controversial, as you can imagine, amongst the Israeli right wing. Both things have never actually been done before. It'll be a very tough sell for him amongst his own right wing base.
While he's, you know, on trial, the most serious case against Netanyahu accuses him of promoting regulations that delivered millions of dollars in profits to a telecom company in exchange for positive coverage. Is there a sense he could be convicted on any of the charges he faces? And how does that impact this?
Well, it was interesting yesterday. In Jerusalem, there was almost a split-screen drama happening in real time. On one side of town, in Jerusalem District Court, Netanyahu actually appeared in front of the judges at the opening, really, of the witness stage of his corruption trial. And on the other side of town, various party leaders were meeting with the president, as they're obligated to do after an election, to see who would form the next government. So this is really the state of play right now in Israel, really a split screen and a divided country. The corruption trial will take a long time to play out. So it's almost background noise at the moment because it's been going on now, the investigations and now the trial, for a number of years. And Netanyahu has done a good job of convincing his ardent supporters that it's all a witch hunt. It's all a big conspiracy by the deep state here, judicial authorities and legal authorities and the left and the media to try to topple him. And that might sound familiar, but that's the narrative that's been playing now in Israel for a number of years. And even yesterday, Netanyahu gave an unexpected and unplanned speech and really laid into the very judicial authorities that called them into court in the morning.
Just briefly, we have to say he is getting credit, though, for doing a good job with Israel's response to the COVID crisis.
That's absolutely true. Everyone does give him credit for it, but there are a number of issues, including his corruption charges, that play against him. And it really didn't help him in the election that took place 2 weeks ago to get over the hump. And so with everything, including the pandemic response, it didn't quite help him.
Right. Neri Zilber, journalist based in Tel Aviv, also an adjunct fellow of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Neri, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Last night in Indianapolis, history was made in college basketball. Just not the history some fans expected. The Baylor Bears, the underdogs, dominated the Gonzaga Bulldogs 86-70 to win their first national championship.
Final 3 seconds. Baylor, one of the great turnarounds in college athletics history. In scandal and disgrace 2 decades ago, national champions in year 18 for Scott Drew.
Baylor had spent 18 years under Coach Scott Drew trying to rebuild from the ashes after an NCAA investigation in 2003 found players were using drugs and were getting paid by their coaches. Gonzaga fans went into this game expecting to seal a perfect season. They were one win away from becoming the first undefeated team since 1976. But Baylor hammered at Gonzaga with fundamentals, three-pointers, and defense. Here's Gonzaga's Corey Kispert after the game.
You know, they punched us in the mouth right at the get-go, and took a long, long time for us to kind of recover and start playing them even again. And by then it was too late.
In fact, Gonzaga never really recovered. Baylor's head coach, Scott Drew, knew making it this far was the opportunity of a lifetime.
We weren't going to have any regrets with this tournament. We wanted to leave it all on the court, and really blessed with the effort everyone gave us tonight.
That effort earned Baylor a national title and ruined Gonzaga's perfect season.
Okay, go to hearandnow.org if you can right now to see the source of this sound. It's the southern caracara bending its neck back, laying its head right against its back. So odd. Odder still, the striated caracara, a species of this bird of prey found only in the Falklands, as we're told by someone who's spent rare time with them, ornithologist and member of the Texas band Shearwater, Jonathan Myberg.
When the swallows fell from the hills, and the gulls from the sky, the starlings in the millions will feed on the ground where they lie.
After college, Jonathan won a fellowship to document community life at the ends of the earth, including the Falklands, where Darwin first saw striated caracaras 200 years ago. Jonathan would later travel down a river in Guyana and cross Chile to find all 10 species, but the striated, which have been compared to mischievous monkeys, is endangered. And Jonathan, your book about your journey is A Most Remarkable Creature, The Hidden Life and Epic Journey of the World's Smartest Birds of Prey. What was it like the first time you saw the striated up close?
These birds, when I met them, just absolutely caught me dead in my tracks. I had never seen anything like them. And they look something like a combination of a crow and a hawk. They just don't act the way you think of a bird of prey acting, or any wild animal for that matter. They come right up to you. They look at you like they've got as much right to be there as you, and they, if you sit down, they might start trying to take things out of your bag. They look right into your eyes with this sort of uncanny consciousness. And I was just astonished by them from the moment that I saw them.
What was that like to be around this bird?
I had had some vague idea of the Falklands as this cold, kind of barren place where there was a war when I was a child. What I didn't know is that there are almost 800 islands in the Falklands. And some of them have preserved conditions that have been there for thousands of years, thronged with seabirds, penguins, albatrosses, and I'd never seen anything like it. So then to meet the Karakaras as part of this environment, that they were living among all these seabirds and seals and everything, but they seemed to have been minted from some different mold or something. They just didn't, almost suddenly like they didn't belong, like they'd ended up there by mistake. And you add that to their curiosity and their general sort of charm. I mean, they'll play games with you. Sometimes you'll see a shadow sort of merging with your own shadow below you, and then look up and there'll be one dangling just like about a foot or two over your head, just wanting to tap you on the top of the head and then fly away, like they're trying to play tag with you.
Well, they've been compared to dogs. They have some sort of intelligence. Darwin saw them and thought they were, what, fake eagles. You know, like, you're not really
eagles,
false eagles, right?
Well, Darwin actually spilled more ink about these birds in The Voyage of the Beagle than he did any other bird. He was really struck by them. They stole hats and, most memorably, a small cater's compass in a red Morocco leather case, which was never recovered, he said, and flying off with them. So what you see when you're reading Darwin's account is these animals meeting human beings for the first time and trying to figure out what to do about us.
And they are somewhat endangered. We'll pick up on that, but as you continue to your travels to find the 10, there's 10 different species of the Karakara. You also traveled with a young researcher you discovered through his online lecture. Red-throated Karakaras are way cool because they are the wasp-murdering superheroes of the rainforest.
Yes. I should say that Karakaras are sort of like what South America has instead of crows. They're falcons, essentially, but it's like somebody built a crow on a falcon chassis. And in the tropics, there's a very special one of these Karakaras. It's called red-throated Karakaras. And they eat almost entirely nothing but wasps' nests. And I met this researcher, Sean McCann. I contacted him and said, would you want to go back down to where you studied them in the Guyanas? And he agreed, sight unseen.
So you become two wacky guys floating down a river with wasps and super spiders looking for these birds, and you see them. But I want to jump ahead in your story, because not all of the species of the Karakara are endangered, but the striated are, and as you describe it to us, it has a lot to do with the geography of where they are, hemmed in by rising seas. And you have a light bulb moment in Brooklyn where you see a marching band of what seems like immigrants, and you have this idea that maybe they could be brought here.
The band that I saw marching around the corner was a group of people from the highlands of the Andes. And throughout the Andes, there are different species of Karakaras in the highlands, some of which were venerated by people like the Inca. But I was looking at this group of people who were preserving this cultural tradition from a place that was very, very far away, and thinking about how striated Karakaras might be transplanted to another place and that they might be able to survive there. A question that many people have when they meet striated Karakaras is, why aren't these birds everywhere? And as you said, they're kind of hemmed in at this bottom corner of the world. There's not anywhere really for them to go, as opposed to ravens, which inherited the northern hemisphere where there's land everywhere. So what could we do that would allow these birds to survive? Why is it important, though, that these birds survive? The extinction of one animal species or another doesn't affect most people in our everyday lives. And yet, when you meet them, it's very easy to become convinced that it's essential that these animals live. They represent something so strange and so beautiful that's managed to figure out environments and climate and everything over such a long period of time, that since it's kind of our fault that they've become so restricted, it's on us to save them. As seas rise, we talk about climate refugees as a human problem, and it is, but it's also a problem for non-human living things. Everything that lives on islands is threatened.
Well, and to underscore their intelligence, they gather in groups to turn over boulders to search for prey. You say no other birds have ever been seen cooperating, you know, to lift heavy objects. I mean, when I read that sentence, the next scene I see is they run en masse and pick up a, you know, an automobile from a pedestrian. You know, they're so incredible. But they're endangered. What do you want people to do?
Well, one of the things I really took away from this entire journey was a sense that the world is much less known than we think. The entire world does not live on the internet. The entire world does not even live in books. Not everything that is known is written, and not everything written is known. If there's anything I want people to come away with, it's an interest in looking outside of the things that we're just told are important.
You talk of people who have brought caracaras to bird preserves. One, Tina, you know, she could fetch toys. I mean, just amazing. Have you ever thought of getting one? Or is that, would that be the opposite of how you feel about this bird?
That's not possible for all kinds of reasons, but the people who do live with them develop these extraordinarily intense relationships with them that are like friendships. These birds want company. They want friends. And they'll take you. Despite the fact that 600 million years of evolutionary time lies between them and us.
That's Jonathan Myberg, a musician in the Texas bands Shearwater and Loma, but also author of the new book, A Most Remarkable Creature, The Hidden Life and Epic Journey of the World's Smartest Birds of Prey. Jonathan, it was just a delight. Thank you.
It was a pleasure, Evan. Thank you.
Like many corporations, Facebook set ambitious targets to hire a more diverse workforce after last year's unrest over the death of George Floyd. Civil rights leaders have described the company's progress on those goals as abysmal, and now current and former employees are speaking out. Elizabeth Dwoskin is Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Liza, hi.
Hey.
Tell us about this former Facebook recruiter you've spoken with, whose experience at the company kind of exemplifies the problem I just laid out there. His name is Rhett Lindsay.
Yeah, so Rhett is a man who's had, he said, 7 years working and recruiting for technical roles at places like Disney and Tinder. And he was so excited to work at Facebook that he applied there 3 times. He started in early 2020. And one of the things he was most excited about was to help with the diversity push. He's a Black man working in HR. HR is a field dominated by white women, largely. And he was really excited to especially recruit more Black engineers because those are the highest paid people at the company. But what he's finding is a climate of microaggressions and isolation that a lot of employees, not just recruiters, felt. And also this numbers game. They have a system where they want to recruit more people of color and underrepresented minorities. So there's, and that includes women too, because there are not very many women engineers there. So they're saying you have to check how many people you recruited of a certain race or ethnicity, or if they were a veteran. And sometimes they would look on people's LinkedIn bios or Instagram. They were heavily encouraged to use Instagram. So he said people were mistagging women as men because later in the interview process, they would realize who they were. He said people were mistagging people's race because they would have these sort of weekly quotas where every week they would have to say, you pinged 6 Black people and recruited 5 Latinos. And they would just want to make their numbers.
Well, another thing that we're hearing from Rhett Lindsay is this a phrase that I think is very interesting, that Black job applicants said that they were often told Facebook was looking for people who would fit in cultural. There's this issue of cultural fit. What does that mean exactly?
So the people they pull are from the networks of friends of the current rosters of employees. And that's not so uncommon at many companies. But what he says the result is that because the current employee base is largely white and Asian, it ends up kind of creating a biased outcome against employees of color who don't come from those networks.
So in other words, if we're talking about culture, and I put that in quotation marks, if the company is made up mostly of white and Asian workers, that's the quote-unquote culture. And that's why this system doesn't work.
Exactly. What is the culture but the people who make up the company, really? It becomes informal, and that's where the bias comes in.
So last year, when CEO Mark Zuckerberg defended the company's decision to give former President Trump wide latitude in posting comments that many saw as racist, I understand, and you hinted at this, that that was a problem and part of the discomfort that many people were feeling inside the company. How did that affect morale there?
I think I have a comment in the story from a former executive who's Black who resigned. And that person said it was one of the most psychologically unsafe experiences that one can have to come into work. You know, you are already feeling unsafe in your neighborhood or on the street because of what's going on in the country. And then you come into work and instead of feeling supported by your colleagues or the management or the atmosphere at the company, you feel completely unsafe at work. And so it tanked morale. They haven't recovered from that. You know, for a company that pays so much, it's surprising to me the number of people who have felt alienated and who have left.
So I think it's worth noting that, you know, this conversation we're having is not just an issue at Facebook or even just in tech, because a lot of companies are publicly saying right now that they want to change their hiring practices. They want to be more inclusive and equitable. But it's tough in practice, isn't it? What does Facebook have to teach them?
Yeah, I'm so glad you went there, because one of the pieces that Lindsay pointed out was he said, we recruiters, we have these diversity pledges. And so we just have to basically go online, go on social media and just guess people's races based on their skin tone. If they don't tell me anything else, like I'm in, you know, the national chapter of Hispanic engineers, you can guess the person's Hispanic. But, you know, if they don't tell me anything else or give another affiliation, then I'm just going to go in and guess. And particularly with gender, we know how sensitive that is. And the reason that they're guessing is because of civil rights laws. Civil rights laws actually effectively prohibit making race or any other protected characteristic, disability, gender, sexual orientation, as a condition of employment. I cannot make that the reason for your employment or for not employing you. And because of that, if you were to ask outright, you would run into legal risk. And so companies are trying to evolve systems where essentially they can't directly ask. And yet when they guess, you can see how problematic that is, particularly as you know, the companies are pledging more diversity more publicly and pushing for it internally, and yet they're coming up against a whole legal framework that's actually meant to protect from discrimination.
These are structural problems that go way, way back. Liza Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. And Robin, by the way, it's good to hear your voice.
Oh, thank you. I'll tweet out a picture of my new knee. No, I won't. That would not be pretty. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.